It's Let's Talk Legal here on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, eponymously known as Harvell and Collins, interestingly enough, and that's Harvell and Collins Law Firm, located, by the way, on Bridges Street, Morehead City. I'll give you, the phone number, 252 area code 726-9050. And as we begin the program, Cecil, Wes, I hope you like the use of the word eponymously.
Thank
good
you.
Morning, Lockwood, or good afternoon, rather.
I had to look that word up. Good afternoon to you both. Thanks for joining us, as always. What is the topic for today?
Lockwood, we are going to speak today about really an area of the law where we get a lot of questions from clients, from families, regarding asset protection in the event that a loved one or an individual ends up having to go into a care facility, and how are we going to be able to pay for the $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 a month of a skilled nursing facility expense? What are the options with regard to that? What are the rules with regard to protecting my home, my other assets? So we're going to get that topic fairly broadly today.
All right. This is one of those issues that I'm confident also includes and incorporates income, or if you will, values, asset values, and things of this nature. Am I thinking correctly on that?
Well, Lockwood, it depends on the level of care as to income, and there's so many places to kind of hop off here and get going, and that's just as good as any. A lot of our clients will contact us and want us to assist them in qualifying for Medicaid when they are in assisted living, okay? Mm-hmm. Assisted living here in Morehead City, we have Carteret Landing. We have, what was Brookdale or Carolina House out actually a little bit in that area on 24. We have a couple of others in Swansboro that have recently been built, and then you move to Newbern. But assisted living, Medicaid will not pay for assisted living unless the income threshold unless there is an income threshold that is met. Mm-hmm. And in assisted living, it really isn't referred to as Medicaid. It's called assisted living assistance. And there are income thresholds. And generally speaking, Lockwood, one can obtain assisted living assistance if potentially their income every month is less than $1,200. This is an estimate now, because it changes, and we look at it each and every time. But around the $1,200 mark. If they're in memory care, then it would be $1,500 a month of income. And this is the income, not combined income, of the husband and the wife, but the income of the recipient. So with regard to assisted living assistance, there is a look, if you will, at what is the applicant's income. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Lockwood, with regard to long-term care, which is known as nursing care or skilled care, there is no income level of qualification. You can have $4,000 or $5,000 of income every month. There's going to be a catch to that. But in terms of income, you can have a significant income every month. Medicaid will pay the difference between your income and the cost of the care. So if the care is $8,000 and your income is $4,000, then Medicaid is going to pick up $4,000 or half of the expense. But now again, Lockwood, this is relative to long-term care or nursing home. So for nursing home assistance, we are not going to be trapped by income. For assisted living assistance, we are.
Okay.
Now, with both of those things said, let me hasten to say there is an asset qualification amount, and that is $2,000. So we can talk all day long about the fact that the applicant has $4,000 of income every month, and the other $4,000 will be paid by Medicaid. But goodness gracious, they've got a home place that's paid for, and they have, you know, $100,000 CD. Well, guess what? That's going to be a problem because they have assets that exceed the $2,000 threshold.
Wow.
And so we're going to need to work with that client in reallocating the assets of that person. I want Wes to chime in here, too, in a minute and say it from a different perspective. But what I always tell clients is we're going to help you put the square pegs in the square hole and the round pegs in the round holes so as to reallocate your assets. You aren't going to necessarily lose your assets. We're going to protect your assets, but they're not going to be able to remain in the same form that they are in currently when your loved one makes application for Medicaid in a nursing facility.
All right. We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. HarvellandCollins.com, and spell out the word and. HarvellandCollins.com is the website. Also, the number, 252 area code, 726-9050. I'm intrigued with this issue of the reallocation of assets. My question, of course, is timing on that sort of thing. Cecil, Wes?
Right, I'll chime in on that. So basically, Lockwood, let's take the scenario that Cecil just laid out for us, okay? We have an individual, and this could be a married person. The rules are a little bit different with someone who is married, but the planning is still very much the same. But let's just take the individual. Let's say this individual has a paid-for home and $100,000 CD. Mm-hmm. That's basically the assets. So if this person ends up having a stroke or having some type of cognitive issue like a vascular dementia or an Alzheimer's or something that leads this person into a point where he can't care for himself anymore. Mm-hmm. And has to be placed in a skilled nursing facility, then if nothing is done whatsoever and this person has to go into the skilled nursing facility, then this person is going to be on private pay until his assets are below $2,000.
Right, right.
Okay. And that private pay will be somewhere around, in our experience, $6,500, $7,000, $6,000, $7,500, depending on some variables per month.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's obviously very expensive, and most people can't sustain that for very long.
Right.
So there's a depletion of the money, and then after the money is gone, then if the circumstances are right, then an intent to return home could be signed. So the home could be not subject to that $2,000 threshold, but it's possible that if the circumstances are not right, meaning there's not someone to sign for this person, or this person doesn't have, there's no power of attorney in place,
right,
or this person doesn't have loved ones or who are able to help him with this, then maybe you can't sign an intent to return home, and then the home place is countable. So
okay,
be that as it may, whether you, I'm kind of getting off on a different issue, but that's somewhat of a catch-22 with regard to that intent to return home. Let me kind of go back to where I was.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're spending our money down at $7,000 a month until that $100,000 is gone. Okay, if the intent to return home is signed, then the home won't be countable, but it will be subject to a lien when the person dies. What that means is that Medicaid, Medicaid will keep under or keep up with the amount that is paid for this person's long-term care expenses, and then when the person dies, they will have a lien on the title of that home, and they'll force the sale of that home to be reimbursed.
Okay.
So that's what happens in a no-planning situation. So what have we done? We've spent, $100,000 depending on how long the person has been in the facility, our life savings is gone. Our house may be gone as well, because it would be subject to a lien and a forced sale through state recovery upon the death of the person. So that's the no plan scenario. So we've lost basically everything, depending on how long the person is in the facility. Now contrast that with the reallocation of assets that Cecil mentioned. Okay, so let's look first at the home. All right, as it relates to the home, proper planning, and it can be done in different ways, but we determined that the best way to do the planning is to use a trust, really two trusts, to structure the title of the property in a way so it's tenants in common, it's there for the benefit of the person who is needing the care if he needs it, and then upon his death it passes to his loved ones, whoever it may be. We're talking about an individual, so probably children. And by structuring the home in the proper way, there's no look-back period. Now, that kind of goes to your question, Lockwood. You had a question about, well, how long do I have to wait? What about timing?
Right.
Well, if it's done properly, then we avoid the five-year look-back period. So on day one, we could do the planning to protect the home using the trust. On day two, meaning the very next day, the home place is a non-countable asset, number one, and it's not subject to it whatsoever. Okay, so the home is immediately off the radar screen because the way it's structured. So, boom, by doing step number one, what have we done? We've already protected the home completely.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so you see the benefit of that planning.
Yes. The interesting thing, and we're talking about this with Wes Collins there and Cecil Harvell, of course, of Harvell and Collins, and I want to remind you, as we talk about this today, don't hesitate to give them a call, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, Harvell and Collins, about the topic of, for all intents and purposes, estate planning. I want to make mention of this very quickly, Cecil. Last week, you and I were talking about estate planning. This is, if you will, an extension. We're talking about Medicaid, and you know, a lot of us don't think about that in relationship to how we plan our estates and things of this nature. Wes, I'm very intrigued with step number one, of course, related to protecting the house. I do have a quick question on that, though. You know, you said the state would attempt to step in if, in fact, the house is used as, if you will, a financial structure for undergirding the Medicaid payments. I'm curious, in the case of a house that already has a lien on it and the tenant who's now in long-term care, of course, then exercises that process and the state steps in and provides the difference on care for that individual, and you said they take a lien on that house. What happens in a situation where there's an already existing lien? I don't mean to complicate it, but I'm curious, has that situation arisen, and is it a fairly simple solution?
Well, they would be, if there was a lien on the house, then it would be, and let's say there's a mortgage already on the house.
Right.
The lien for estate recovery would be in second position.
Okay.
So they couldn't jump ahead of the mortgage that's already on the house.
Right.
Okay, but keep in mind that the planning that we're proposing and that we do on a very routine basis and have for many, many years avoids that lien possibility whatsoever. Now, Lockwood, we have folks come into our office, you know, after someone has passed away and who's been in a skilled nursing facility who have received notice that there's a lien on their parents' home. And they didn't know that was going to happen. They thought that by signing the intent to return home, which is a carve-out in the law that allows you to keep the home place from being countable in that $2,000 threshold, that the home was protected forever. Well, they get a rude awakening with a notice, the lien on the property after the person has passed away. The planning that we do avoids that altogether. So that let me just briefly go back to the fact that, you know, walking through the scenario, we still have $100,000 left.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we protected the home, but there's the $100,000 CD. Well, we're $98,000 away from Medicaid covering the cost of our care because we have to get down to $2,000. So now, after we protected the home, then we look at a spend down. We look at what we can do in order to spend $98,000 down. And what we're looking for under the law, which is under the Medicaid law, is very, very complex, very extensive as it relates to the things you're allowed to do to spend down. We're wanting to spend that $98,000 down, not on the cost of care at $7,000 a month to the facility,
mm-hmm.
because we just lose that part of our life savings completely once we've done that. We're wanting to spend that money down in a way that is beneficial to our family and to ourselves.
Uh-huh.
You've already brought up number one on the list. Let's say that that home place we protected has a $50,000 mortgage on it. That's what's left. Well, we can spend $50,000 by paying that mortgage off, and that is a direct benefit to the family.
Right.
Okay, but it is an allowable spend down.
Okay.
So we have already spent $50,000 of the $98,000. If it happens to be $98,000 on the mortgage, we'll just pay the mortgage off.
Mm-hmm.
Other things, there's just a whole host of things that, you know, this program doesn't lend itself to us going through every detail with regard to this. But just to say that we've dealt with just about every scenario there is as it relates to spending down that liquid asset. In many cases, we're buying assets. For example, you can have one automobile. I know this person who is in the facility is not going to be driving, but the person can have an automobile if the automobile is used by the family for the person, like to pick the person up, take them to the doctor, take them to church, mm-hmm. take them to on Sunday afternoon drives, you know, whatever it may be. So that would be an allowable spend down. Other pieces of real property in the event that we have a sizable spend down that we need to do,
mm-hmm.
we can use the money to hold real property and then place those properties in our trust. There's just dozens, if not hundreds, of options that are available with regard to an allowable spend down that benefits the family. But, you know, if you don't have that knowledge and don't know how the law works with regard to that, then you end up in a situation where you lose everything, like we explained what happens when you have the no plan.
Right. You know,
the plan really allows you to protect everything you have, depending on, you know, the way that the assets are structured. But we, again, deal with the structure of the assets for clients all the time and deal with this on the front end for the planning. Do mm-hmm. it. We deal with it during the application process when the person is applying. And stand confident in the plan that we use and help the client with that process, and then deal with it upon the death of the client after they have been in the facility for years and reap the benefit of the planning we put in place. So my point with that is that we deal with this on all aspects, planning stage, application stage, and then after the person passes away, where if you have no plan, there will be a lien.
Right. We're talking, that was Cecil Harvell, and we're talking with, I'm sorry, that was Wes Collins. I apologize, Wes. We're talking with Wes Collins there a moment ago on the issue of Medicaid and dispersal of assets. And Cecil and I, of course, Wes, we talked about this last week in the planning of wills and estates and powers of attorneys and things of this nature. The thing that I find interesting about this is that, you know, long-term care is it, and I'm going to say a relatively new experience. Over the past, say, 40 years, maybe even shorter, 20 years, the whole aspect of long-term care has become, well, expensive, very complicated. So these are the sort of things that I gather you talk to your clients when they come in and start planning and looking forward. These are, a lot of people never even think about, well, the use of Medicaid. Am I correct in that?
Lockwood, the way that I would put it is that so many of our clients who are also very wonderful, I might add, are need to be focused. Okay, I think a great word to use to respond to your question is the word focus. They generally know about these things. They've heard about it. They maybe have experienced it with an elder brother, sister, someone in the church, etc. But they are inquisitive about it. But they need a lawyer to like Wes or myself to help them focus on the planning that can be done. And so what we do, and this plays back into last week's program, and we probably maybe can talk about this again next week, is that absolutely, Lockwood, we begin the conferences with what you and I talked about last week. Let's get a strong, well-drafted power of attorney. Mm-hmm. Let's get your will done, a health care power of attorney, a HIPAA release. Let's get these standard estate planning documents up to date and in good form. And then you kind of peel back the onion a little bit and you begin to move in a direction where you focus the client on this potential planning called asset protection planning. You know, do you have long-term care insurance? Some folks have it.
Right.
Sometimes these issues are just simply not going to apply for asset protection planning, Lockwood, because the clients are, you know, very, very wealthy, you know, and have extraordinary, liquid accounts that will take care of, you know, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, a month. If a client has, you know, a $5 million Merrill Lynch account, then we may not do a whole lot of discussion about asset protection planning, okay? And where the cutoff on that is, by the way, is not fixed. It's more of a decision for the client as to how far they want their planning to go in light of the assets that they have. But it is a matter of peeling back the onion and then discussing, well, you know, there are some circumstances that could confront your family with regard to long-term care. Maybe we should consider putting your home place into a trust to protect it. Mm-hmm. The trust then is there in the toolbox for your family if at some point we need it in order to utilize protecting some of the money in some other format. There is, as Wes was mentioning, just a laundry list of things that we go through that are permissible spend-down items of the liquidity, improvements to the real estate, the purchase of a handicap van, the making of the house handicap accessible, the redoing of any kind of, you know, bathroom facility or anything of that nature, a downstairs bedroom, mother-in-law suite. The list is just endless. Paying the funeral ahead of time, retiring any debt. We mentioned before the mortgage debt, but the Medicaid law allows us to pay any back taxes, any credit card debt, any debt whatsoever that the applicant might have. And then, of course, after we go through this laundry list, then potentially we would shift some of the liquidity into maybe possibly a rental income investment, whereby to replace some of the income that we're losing with the applicant that is in the nursing facility. You know, if the husband goes into a nursing facility first, Lockwood, sometimes that leaves the wife or the community spouse in the community with a much lower income because Medicaid will take the $3,000 or $4,000 that the husband has, and the wife's income is only $600 or $700 of Social Security. So that needs to be looked at. That needs to be put into the formula.
We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. That was Cecil Harvell a moment ago about the issue of planning, estate planning, and bringing in the topic of Medicaid. I think this, as we wrap things up, gentlemen, I had never even considered what you were talking about, knowing that Medicaid is out there, but didn't realize how it works. So I think this is an important issue. In closing, I just want to remind folks don't hesitate to give Cecil and Wes a call and the rest of the team at Harpell and Collins. They have a complete team of attorneys there to help you, tax attorneys as well, which I'm sure this plays a role in the conversation. The number, 252 area code 726-9050. That's 726-9050. Cecil, Wes, I'm looking forward to next week's conversation about this, how this goes forward. Thank you very much for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station.